Usually, we have two speakers, ladies and gentlemen, on this very complex topic, and the purpose is to get two perspectives. This is the first time we've had a speaker continually quote the person who's supposed to give the other perspective.
It's a nasty little bit.
Yeah, and so your assignment now is to quote from Eliot's book. We didn't mean for it to be a total love fest, but Shadi Hamid is at Brookings Institution right now, and he's just come out from Oxford University Press. This is a wonderful new book called Temptations of Power, Islamists and Illiberal Democracy in a New Middle East. It's been out for, since when? Last April? Yeah, so we're delighted you could be here with us. Shadi did his undergraduate work and master's at Georgetown University and his PhD in political science at Oxford University. And he is a fellow with a project on U.S. relations with the Islamic world at the Center for Middle East Policy at Brookings Institution, and we're delighted he can be with us. Shadi, thank you.
Thanks so much, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here. Okay. So let me just maybe start a little bit with where I come from on this issue of Islamists and Islamism. So I started conducting research on Islamist movements in 2004, 2005. I was a Fulbright Fellow in Jordan, and I was a naive graduate student at the time. And I would kind of hang out at the Muslim Brotherhood headquarters in Amman. I would spend a lot of time in their archive room. And really, ever since then, I've been absolutely hooked. I find Islamist groups quite fascinating for a number of reasons. Now, My basic starting point is that we don't have to like Islamists, but we have to understand them. And the only way to understand them is by doing something rather simple. Sit down with them, get to know them, talk to them as real individuals with their own hopes, fears, and aspirations. So that's really what I've tried to do over the past 10 years in my research, primarily in Egypt, Jordan, and Tunisia, is I wanted to immerse myself in their world. And since we're talking about religion here, I've kind of gone through an evolution that over these past 10 years, I've come to appreciate more the independent power of religion and ideology when understanding these groups. And so, for example, I think there's a session about this in the afternoon, why social scientists don't get religion or something to that effect. And as someone who's trained in political science, there's been a tendency to see religion and ideology as epiphenomenal. In other words, the product of a given set of material factors. So the political context, the economic context, is what explains the rise or fall of political Islam or the success of these groups and so on. And that these groups use and abuse religion. They instrumentalize religion for political ends. But when you actually spend time with the rank and file in the Muslim Brotherhood, you start to realize that they're not really instrumentalizing. That's not how they see it. They believe in this deeply. It's deeply and honestly felt. So for example, I mean, I've had Brotherhood members tell me that one of the reasons they joined the Brotherhood is to get into heaven. That's not political. That's not about power. They believe that being part of this organization, which is much more than a political party, it has a religious and educational program. There's an ideological framework that you grow up with as a member of the Brotherhood that helps them become better Muslims, and that's their primary goal. But I saw this perhaps in a really striking fashion after the military, or I should say, yeah, during and after the military coup in Egypt. So the military coup happened July 3rd, 2013, and then there was a very brutal crackdown afterwards. On August 14th, 2013, we had the Rabaa massacre, which was. According to Human Rights Watch, the worst mass killing in modern Egyptian history. And I was actually in Egypt and spending time interviewing Brotherhood members and leaders in Rabaa just a few days before the massacre happened. Now, we didn't know, no one really knew whether the massacre would actually happen, when it would happen, but it was a very tense and frightening atmosphere. But there was something very interesting to me in kind of talking to them at this point, because their backs were against the wall, and they were actually willing to die. And there was almost this kind of rhetoric of self-sacrifice that that protesting against the coup and perhaps dying in the process was their cross to bear, if you will. And this is where, you know, all the time I've spent with Islamist groups, this is, I feel like I understand them pretty well. The one thing I struggle with is the willingness to die. And I'll just, let me talk about that for a second or two. There was actually, and they were in fact willing to die, because more than 800 of them died in just mere hours on that day. But there was a very interesting anecdote that a Brotherhood member who was in Rabat at the time, who's now in exile, we were talking a few months ago, and he relayed this very interesting anecdote. It might be somewhat exaggerated, but I think the point holds. He said that, you know, there was this person he knew that was on the front lines of the protests as the military was threatening to come in, and he wanted to be on the front lines. And as the military came in, they were getting shot at, and a bullet grazed his shoulder, and he turns behind him, and the person behind him is shot and falls to the floor and is dying. And then he starts to cry in seeing his colleague behind him. He was obviously sad, but he was also sad that he wouldn't be a martyr that day, that he was longing to die in God's cause, but he missed his chance. Now, I don't want to overgeneralize and say that's what everyone in Rabat thought, but the fact that there are some people who feel so strongly and so powerfully about these ideas that they're actually not just accepting death but welcoming it, that's a very interesting idea to me that I struggle to get my head around. But anyway, I'll get back to that later on. But I think that is something we have to ask ourselves about. Now, let me then kind of use this to kind of segue into ISIS. And I want to emphasize that I do not see the Muslim Brotherhood and ISIS as two sides of the same coin. And I'll talk about that more as I close up. But I think they're quite different in both their means and ends, and we have to be, and it's important to make distinctions. That said, I think the religious inspiration is something that we can see across the Islamist spectrum. They use it, it leads to different ends, but they are animated by a set of powerful ideas. Now, I think that because of the Edward Said's legacy and the charges of Orientalism, I think for the last few years, especially in academia, I think there's a fear of going too much in this direction of privileging religion over other factors. But I think we've gone, and I think that that's well-intentioned, that you don't want to culturally essentialize, you don't want to say, you don't want to other Muslims or Islam and make them out into this kind of boogeyman. But at the same time, I think we've gone too much in that direction, where this fear of being tagged with cultural essentialism has prevented us from really appreciating the role of religion. So I think we have to kind of correct, and there's a middle ground somewhere in between where we take into account religion as a powerful explanatory factor or independent variable along with political factors. That's not to say that political factors don't matter. They obviously do, and we can see how failures of governance and the lack of security in the Middle East has contributed to ISIS's rise. So it's clearly not just about religion, or perhaps even primarily about religion, but we have to take into account these different factors. So for example, and I'll just mention a couple ways it really matters when we're trying to understand the rise of ISIS, is, for example, in June, we have the fall of Mosul, the second largest city in Iraq. And here you have about 900 fighters who are able to overtake the city and defeat a force of 30,000 plus members of the Iraqi army and Iraqi security forces. And I think we've seen this time and time again, that a small group of ideologically committed individuals are able to get a lot more done than their numbers might suggest. So in that sense, religion, ideology, the willingness to die are force multipliers. It gets you very far, and it's not just with groups like ISIS. I mean, I was struck by how little attention this got, but the capital of a U.S. ally fell the other month, and people didn't seem to care a whole lot. I mean, the capital of Yemen fell to rebels. And these are Shia rebels, so they're quite different than ISIS, but I think the same idea holds that, again, a small group of ideologically committed fighters are able to overtake U.S.-backed military forces. So that's one component. Another way of looking at it is that ISIS, the overwhelming majority of Muslims do not share ISIS's ideology, but that's not to say that ISIS doesn't draw on ideas that have broad resonance among Muslim majority populations. And this is where I think, from a marketing standpoint, they've been quite smart and quite revolutionary, I should add, that before ISIS, extremist groups didn't mess with the idea of the caliphate. The caliphate, because of its historical weight, you can kind of talk about it as an inspiration or an aspiration, but you didn't actually do it in real life. Al-Qaeda never actually tried to establish an actual caliphate. And this is where I think ISIS, even if it's defeated tomorrow morning, has, in some sense, will have a lasting impact in the region because they forced Muslims to re-engage with the idea of a caliphate. And the idea of a caliphate is something that I would say most Muslims are sympathetic to, not in terms of its actual implementation, but in terms of the role that it played in their own history. And I grew up in a relatively secularized American Muslim community in Pennsylvania, but the caliphate, or if you want to put it differently, the Islamic empire of past, was something that was the subtext of so many conversations that I was part of growing up. Whether it was in Pennsylvania talking to other members of the Muslim community or in my travels to the Middle East, because the caliphate historically was symbolic of when we were the greatest civilization the world had ever seen in science, technology, education. This was the peak. And so much what part of the struggle with modernity now is to understand how we as Muslims encountered one of the most precipitous declines in human history. How did we go from that just a few centuries ago to where we are now? And I think that gap between who we were and what we currently are, or what we think we should be, is a very profound gap, and it's a gap that drives a good deal of the anger and humiliation that in turn lead to political violence. So that's where I think the caliphate isn't a strictly religious concept. It also has a kind of political power. There was a very interesting article the other day in El Monitor talking about how discussions about a caliphate, again, not ISIS's caliphate, but about a caliphate conceptually, have become much more routine in Turkey in the last few months, where prominent Turkish writers are kind of hearkening back to the memory of the caliphate, and Erdogan himself is drawing on this symbolism and imagery and some, you know, oftentimes portraying himself as the kind of the caliph in waiting. So now that the mental block of the caliphate has been removed, I think we're going to see this for the foreseeable future, that Islamist groups and Muslims are going to actually have a conversation about the legacy of the pre-modern Islamic State or the pre-modern caliphate and what it means in the current context. Now, let me kind of broaden this out and talk a little bit more about the role of Islam, because I think that we're not just talking about ISIS, and this is something that we saw in the whole Bill Maher-Ben Affleck debate, where Bill Maher took something that was about ISIS, but then it was a bigger discussion about is there something wrong with Islam as a religion? And, you know, it's nice to see Ben Affleck defending defending Muslims, it's well-intentioned, and I was kind of, you know, I think a lot of us were cheering him on because we almost, you know, no one ever defends Muslims in the public sphere, at least not famous people. But at the same time, Ben Affleck's, I think, analysis was a bit superficial. Understandably, he's not a religious scholar. But I think this is where we have to kind of go into some uncomfortable territory. I do think that Islam is distinctive in how it relates to politics, but I don't think that's necessarily good or bad. I think it just is. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that Muslims aren't bound to their founding moment, but they can't fully escape it either. And Prophet Muhammad, unlike, say, Jesus and other prophets, was not just a theologian, a cleric, a man of God, but also the head of a political community. He was a politician, a merchant, a warrior, all intertwined into one. And this has major implications, especially since many Muslims look back to the prophetic model as an inspiration. And because of that precedent, it's harder to make the case for secularism in the sense of separation of religion from politics, because that's clearly not something Prophet Muhammad was trying to do. And if we look at, in comparison to, say, the founding moment of Christianity, Jesus was not the head of a political community. He was a dissident, and his message was at least somewhat otherworldly and more spiritually focused. It wasn't really concerned with practical issues of everyday governance and what it means to apply Christianity to the state. So founding moments matter, I believe. And then we can talk about other things too. The creedal requirement to be a Muslim is to believe in the divinity of the text, and to believe that it's literally exactly God's word. So if, for example, if you believe that Prophet Muhammad was inspired by God, but that he wrote the Quran himself, you would not be considered a Muslim from the standpoint of creed. And that's with mainstream scholars across the board. That is also somewhat different from the other monotheistic religions, that there's a more intense attachment to the text, where, for example, over time, Christians and Jews, you can be both a Christian or a Jew, if you don't believe in the divinity of the text in the sense that this is coming directly from God. Now, not to go too much into all of that, but this doesn't mean all of this is relevant. It doesn't mean, though, that reform is impossible. And this gets us into the debate of, can there be an Islamic reformation? And this is where I think we have to be careful about comparisons. Islam has already had a kind of reformation, but the reform has led in a direction that we're probably not going to be comfortable with. So in the Christian case, or in the case of pre-modern Europe, the decline of the clerics and the rise and mass literacy and mass education paved the way for the product, what became known as the Protestant Reformation, which then paved the way for the Enlightenment. So in that sense, the decline of the clerics and secularism went hand in hand over time. What we see in the Islamic context is a little bit different, that the decline of the clerics and mass literacy actually has coincided with the rise of political Islam. And if we look at the late 19th century, early 20th century, we have the Islamic modernists, which were the precursor to mainstream Islamism of the Brotherhood, let's say. And what they were doing was actually an attempt to modernize. That's as their name would suggest, that they were trying to reconcile pre-modern Islamic law with the modern nation state. And that is, in fact, more or less still what the project of groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, And this is where they're criticized by those on the far right for not being as textually literalist and not as committed to the pre-modern approaches to Islamic law. They're more flexible, let's say. So, and it's also worth noting that groups like the Brotherhood are certainly non-clerical. They're mostly doctors, engineers, and lawyers if we look at their leadership, but they're also in many cases anti-clerical. So these are some very interesting contrasts with the European experience. Now, as I kind of close up here, you know, it's this, what's interesting is that, so we had essentially a democratization of religious learning. That's what we've had in the Middle East for the past century and a half, again, because of the weakening of the clerical class. But in a counterintuitive way, that's what makes groups like, not just the mainstream Islamists who are more pragmatic, but even groups like ISIS. ISIS would be inconceivable without the democratization of religious learning. There's no clerical control. The establishment clerics have lost their legitimacy, and the message of ultra-conservative Salafis, Wahhabis, and groups like ISIS is that we don't have to worry about the establishment. We can access the text directly in a very literalist way, and this is in part the result. Now, let me try to provide some paths forward, and so what? How do we make sense of all of this? So I think the rise of political Islam, you know, as Eliot pointed out, provides us with a kind of dilemma. And this is the dilemma that I talk about in my book. If the idea of mixing religion and politics is rooted in the political culture of the Middle East, then in any context of democratization, those who are elected are going to have to reflect that religious conservatism. So that's where more democracy could actually lead to less liberalism. And that's why I subtitled my book with the phrase, illiberal democracy. And I would just kind of clarify my position on this. I do believe that groups like the Muslim Brotherhood are committed to the democratic process. That doesn't necessarily, I wouldn't go so far as to say that means they're Democrats or not, because different people mean different thing by the word Democrat. But I do believe that they have come a long way. They have committed themselves to working within the political process, and that is distinctive. Now, but this is where there's a real tension, because they can be committed to the democratic process, but still use their political power to support illiberal ends when it comes to social legislation, when it comes to public morality. And there's a number of examples of what they might do or what they could do if they came to power that would in some ways restrict personal freedoms, whether it's about alcohol consumption, changing the educational curricula, banning co-education at some levels of schooling. There's a lot of examples of what this might be. But I would argue that this is a reality that we may have to accept, that if democracy has any chance of flourishing, we have to accept that Islam is going to play a role. This doesn't mean that, as Eliot said, Islamist parties will always win. Sometimes they might lose, as in Tunisia, because of a disillusion with their period in governance. But the bigger point here isn't Islamist parties, because you can even have ostensibly secular parties who support Islamist policies because they have to appeal to the median voter. This is democracy. If that's what your constituency wants, if that's what voters find appealing, then that's what you'll do. And we see this in cases like Malaysia and Indonesia, where you have ostensibly secular ruling parties, but they've engaged in very aggressive Islamizing rhetoric, even trying to outbid Islamists, which is a very interesting dynamic. And one example of this is the secular government in Malaysia over the past 7 years has upheld a ban on Christians using the word Allah, which is remarkable. And even the Muslim Brotherhood would never dream of doing that in the Middle East, but a secular party is doing that in Malaysia. And also in some local areas in both Indonesia and Malaysia, secular parties have talked about and actually implemented sometimes aspects of Sharia law in those localities that are more conservative, because again, that's more likely to help them win elections. So I think that, you know, so where does that leave us, you know, as Americans or Westerners who are thinking about this from a policy perspective, and what do we do about this? I think we have to go beyond this idea that all good things necessarily go together. If we do believe in democracy and it leads to Islam playing a larger role, we don't have to like it, we don't have to be comfortable with it, but if that's what happens, then that's what happens. Now, you might say, well, what about the alternative? I think the alternative is quite problematic because it requires repression and marginalization of Islamist groups. And that's essentially what we've seen in Egypt, where you've had this very devastating crackdown after the military coup. And I think it's, I have moral qualms with the repression, but even putting that aside, it's a fool's errand, because these are not just organizations. I mean, you can kill an organization, but can you kill an idea that's deeply rooted in these societies? And it's been tried time and time again, vigorous attempts at secularization in Turkey and Tunisia. But once there's a political opening, Islamists reemerge as either the strongest political group or one of the strongest. So why do we keep on falling into this illusion that political Islam can be defeated? Now, I think there's also another risk, and that's by repressing them and not allowing them to participate in state structures or in the political process, that strengthens the narrative of groups like ISIS. And ISIS actually, in their public statements, considers the Muslim Brotherhood and similar groups to be unbelievers. And Adnani's August 2013 statement, right after the coup in Egypt, very harsh attack on the Muslim Brotherhood, and he associates the Brotherhood specifically with the religions of unbelief, which is a very striking thing to say about what would supposedly be a fellow Islamist group. Now, that's why I think it's very important to make those distinctions, and it therefore makes less sense to lump groups like ISIS with groups like the Muslim Brotherhood, because in some ways they're enemies and very antagonistic towards each other. And I'll just close here, and I think this is something that will probably come up in other sessions, is, I mean, my tendency, you know, as a progressive in the kind of more classical sense, or as a classical liberal, as, you know, as someone who grew up in this country, my tendency is to see that societies progress over time, that there's almost this kind of teleological movement towards liberalism, towards reason, towards rationality. And that's what we want to think, and that's what we're in some ways trained to think. But I think we have to start problematizing that more. And if we want to appreciate the role of Islam in public life, we have to raise this question of what if Egyptians, Jordanians, or whoever else decide through the democratic process that they would rather not be liberals? What if they want to try out an alternative ideological project outside the confines of liberal democracy? We might not like that, but that may be where the region is going or will go at some later point.